This is the Everything Financial Radio Program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Welcome. If you are a regular listener, welcome back. You'll be pleased to hear that we have joining us again on today's program one of our favorite special guests, Mr. Jeffrey Tucker. Jeffrey is editor and publisher of Laissez-Faire Books, and we will be talking to him about his most recent book, and I know you'll find the conversation to be just fascinating. Also on today's program, I will be talking about the topics of inflation and deflation and examine what's going on in a couple countries. Argentina is experiencing 40% annual inflation. We'll ask why and could it happen here. Greece, on the other hand, has been experiencing what can only be described as a deflationary depression. Youth unemployment's at 60%. It's just downright miserable, economic speaking, in Greece, and has been for the past 7 years. We'll ask why, and again, could the same thing happen here, and how can both of these economic outcomes be occurring on the same planet at the same time? We'll be talking about inflation, deflation, what direction we're likely to head here, and what you may consider doing with some of your nest egg, or maybe even all of your nest egg. So we hope it'll be a practical program for you today. Quick reminder, if you've not yet attended our new retirement rules class, we just completed one, in fact, this past week. We do have another one that we've scheduled, though, by request on Saturday, June the 13th. That will be held at the downtown campus of Western Michigan University. If you'd like to get more information or register, just visit the website, newretirementrules.com. If you go to the right-hand side of the webpage, there's a place to register there. There's also some information posted there if you'd like to get more information before you register. Again, the website, newretirementrules.com. I'm pleased to have back on Everything Financial Radio returning guest, Mr. Jeffrey Tucker. Jeffrey's most recent book is titled Bit by Bit. We'll talk to him about that. He is also the editor of Laissez-Faire Books, and he's the director of digital development at the Foundation for Economic Education. And Jeffrey, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Jeffrey, tell the listeners about the premise of your book, Bit by Bit.
Well, the premise of it is that we're living in extraordinary times that are unleashing human liberty and opportunities for communication and contact and production and labor all over the world in a way that fundamentally affects our political relationships with the government. And it's a very optimistic book, looking forward to a world of individualism and freedom as brought to us not through the usual channels of politics or even through education or ideological agitation, but through brilliant technological innovation. I'm convinced that this is the way forward for everybody who loves human liberty.
So, Jeffrey, you made a statement that these emerging technologies affect our political relationship with government. Explain.
Yes, and this gets us to the foundation of political philosophy in a way. You know, what is the state? What does it do? What are its opportunities? What are its limits? And when you look at the state as a structure, just as an institution, as something we erected, the promise of was that the state was going to bring us progress, that the specialized sort of management of the social order that we saw beginning of the 20th century would make us healthier, happier, wiser, you know, more prosperous. And I think now that we're in the 21st century, it's becoming increasingly obvious that that is not true. And a lot of the technologies that we've seen emerge over the last 20 years, and really in particular over the last five, have really been workarounds to this huge regulatory structure that has been erected in our times, so that has really ended up making us poorer than we otherwise be and caused, you know, just immense and ongoing problems for every enterprising person in the world, essentially. So the peer-to-peer technology that we were so often use on our smartphones and in the digital world are designed to get around these problems, and they're really being successful. So, you know, why is this? Why am I so anxious to pit, you know, the sort of P2P revolution against the sort of statist status quo. The reason is this. The state is in many ways constrained by two fundamental factors of its existence. The first one is that it always must operate on geographically constrained boundaries. So the state is always juridically circumscribed by geography. So the United States ultimately can only control the United States. Spain can only control Spain, and so on. But the digital world is naturally and inevitably globalized. It doesn't recognize the existence of any nation states as such. It considers all people in the world to be potential cooperators in building civilization. So, you know, it has no regard for boundaries and borders. So these are fundamentally conflicting modes of operation between the digital world and the government. The second thing is that the government's only real power in this world is coercive. It can coerce our bodies and take our property and control the physical world. That's its core sort of competence, if you want to call it that. But the digital world is necessarily, you know, evades the constraints of the physical world. It's weightless and spaceless and moves, you know, with lightning speed and is not subject to the same kind of levels of control that, say, heavy machinery is or agriculture. That's why we call it the digital age. You know, under the age of agriculture, you know, the state could control land. In the capitalist age of heavy machinery, the state can target individual entrepreneurs. There's always insofar as we're only working in the physical world, there's a central point of failure. You know, essentially the government's always going to be in charge. But once you sort of move the great productive machinery of the social order into the digital space, it tends to evade the attempts by the nation state to control it for both those reasons I mentioned. First, that the state is constrained by geography, and second, that it's limited to controlling the physical property. So the digital world then comes again into conflict with traditional political structures. And that's why I say it's a fundamental challenge to the way we've been, you know, managing our lives for the last 100 years or so, or maybe thousands of years.
Well, if you're just joining us, we are chatting with Mr. Jeffrey Tucker, who is the author of Bit by Bit. He's also the editor at Laissez-Faire Books, and he is the director of digital development at the Foundation for Economic Education. Jeffrey, you made a comment that these emerging technologies have kind of really evolved as a way to work around regulation. Interesting thought occurred to me. Is it the regulation that is the catalyst for these emerging technologies, or were we going to see them anyway, regardless of the regulation?
No, I was both, right? I mean, so I think really what happened here is if you look back at the late 19th century, we were seeing great progress. We were largely laissez-faire. There was no income tax. There was no central bank. There were no regulations on schools, medicine, law, anything, you know? And then at the turn of the 20th century, the ruling class erected this massive apparatus of control. You know, they started gigantic global wars. They started regulating, you know, all food and medicine and law and professions, and created central banks and income taxes. So you basically, over the course of 100 years, it's gotten to the point that you can't move. You can't make any money. You can't make any decisions on your own. Everything is intermediated by the state. So that sets up a real frustrating situation because, you know, there's no possibility for innovation under these conditions. The world becomes a static place. Whereas free enterprise is always on the move, always creating things, thinking of new ideas, trying new things, looking for ways to test new ideas to push the limits. So yes, so many of the enterprises that are going on today are challenging these structures, you know, fundamentally. A good example I can think of, just in case the listeners are getting frustrated with the sheer abstraction of my comments here, is something like Airbnb. Airbnb allows you to rent out a home in your house that is otherwise being unused to anybody in the world who happens to be traveling through, and for you to become basically a hotel for a couple of days, you know, and make some money. So you're using unused resources. And the way you do this is through a peer-to-peer contact. and reputation-based systems without the sort of intermediation of a government. Well, that sounds reasonable, except that, you know, that is fundamentally in conflict with things like zoning laws, with public accommodations laws, with vast amounts of state, local, and national regulatory structures. And yet everybody loves it. You know, it works beautifully. And people use Airbnb all the time now. And it's challenging the sort of hotel monopoly in this beautiful way. And the wonderful thing about this is that it's growing at such a pace and benefiting so many people that it becomes very difficult for the regulators and the bureaucrats to just come in and try to shut it down. They tried to do this to Airbnb in New York and were just incredibly unsuccessful. People are looking at this going, hey, look, guys, we've got a housing shortage around here. I can never get a hotel in New York. Everything's ridiculously expensive. Airbnb is providing a solution to my problem. So you politicians and regulators and bureaucrats out there better not intervene. And ultimately, the government had to back down. And we're seeing this not just in hotel accommodations, but in transportation and in money and at office space and the markets for goods and services. Everything is moving towards this peer-to-peer world. And I think it's raising a real challenge. You know, what is the role of the state going forward? And the peer-to-peer revolution really asks us to sort of deal with that fundamental question.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there in this segment. We are chatting with Mr. Jeffrey Tucker, author of Bit by Bit. I'll continue my conversation with him when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. We will continue our conversation with Mr. Jeffrey Tucker when Everything Financial Radio continues in the next segment. In this segment, I want to talk about some things going on economically in some countries around the world and talk about which outcome might be most likely here in the United States, and even more importantly, talk about what that might mean for you and your nest egg. And I'll tell you what I mean. In fact, if you think about it, it's pretty ironic when you take a look at what's going on in the country of Greece. If you're a regular listener to the Everything Financial Radio program, we talked about what was going on in Greece just a couple of weeks ago. It's likely now that the country of Greece will leave the euro. One of the reasons that they'll leave the euro we'll explain in some greater detail as this segment progresses. But essentially, when Greece is in the euro, they don't have the ability to print money. And if you can't print money, there's only two ways to deal with your budget deficit and your debt excesses. You can either raise taxes or you can cut spending. But printing money is not an option. And when debt levels reach a certain point, to the point that they're unsustainable, deflation becomes the overwhelming economic trend. And deflation is frankly very ugly. If you want to think about deflation and want an example that you're undoubtedly familiar with, think about the United States during the Great Depression in the 1930s. That was a deflationary time frame. In a deflationary environment, stocks don't do well. Stocks crash. In a deflationary environment, unemployment is very high. There's a lot of economic pain. That was the United States in the 1930s. That is Greece today. Greece has youth unemployment in the 60% range, and they've seen their economy contract every year for the last 7 years. By contrast, when you take a look at what's going on in the country of Argentina, Argentina can print money. In fact, they've done just that because they've defaulted on debt a couple times. The policymakers in Argentina have three choices to deal with their deficits and debt excesses. They can either raise taxes, cut spending, or print money, and they've decided to print money. In fact, in 2014, the inflation rate in Argentina hit 40%. That makes Argentina one of the countries in the world with the highest inflation rate. In fact, there was a piece on Business Insider this past week that I thought was interesting. There was an ad advertising a Volvo in Argentina in 2001, and the cost of the Volvo was 12,500 pesos. There was an ad advertising a Samsung Galaxy, the cell phone, the mobile phone that likely many of you have. And the cost of that in 2015 is a little over 15,000 pesos. So about the same price 14 years later as you'd have paid for a Volvo 14 years previously. Argentina is suffering from inflation. So how can both of these economic trends occur at the same time on the same planet? And what's most likely to happen here and why? Well, inflation is simply defined as an expansion of the money supply. The money supply expands. There's more money out there, and obviously abundance does not create value. Scarcity creates value. And when money is abundant because they printed more of it, one of the symptoms is rising prices. One of the simplest definitions of inflation, although it's not all that accurate, is too much money chasing too few goods and services. Deflation is the polar opposite of inflation. Deflation is a contraction of the money supply. When the money supply contracts, one of the symptoms is falling prices. Now, if you've been a long-time listener to the program, you may have heard this statistic before, but for new listeners, it's really important to understand this fact. Over 95% of money today is debt. Less than 5% is actual currency, the bills and the coins that we all carry around. 95% of all money is debt. So debt levels and the money supply and whether we get inflation or deflation are very closely related. When debt levels rise to unsustainable levels, debts go unpaid. And when debts go unpaid, money disappears from the financial system, and the natural economic trend to emerge is deflation. You just need to think back to what happened during the financial crisis. Prior to the financial crisis, there were a lot of very inventive bankers making very unique loans and on mortgages, on homes. You could have no money down and you would be able to buy a house. You might be able to have a mortgage that would negatively amortize, meaning that as time went on, the balance on your loan would grow. It was very, very easy to get a loan, and as a result, we saw housing prices just go through the roof. They went up about 50% over a three-year time frame nationally on average. And then one of the causes of the financial crisis was that there was simply too much debt to be paid. So what happened? Well, when someone didn't pay a debt and gave the house back to the bank to satisfy the mortgage, the banker saw money disappear from their balance sheet. If they loaned Mr. Jones $100,000 to buy a house, Mr. Jones decides he doesn't want to make the payments on the house anymore and gives the house back to the bank, and the bank sells the house for $60,000, that's $40,000 of money that disappeared. The money supply contracted, and deflation is the ultimate result. So what happened was the Federal Reserve started to print money. They wanted to add money to the system at least as fast as money was disappearing from the system to avoid deflation. Now, when you look at government debt, there's three choices to deal with government debt, as I stated. You can cut taxes, you can cut spending, you can raise taxes, or you can print money. Argentina has been printing money, so they have massive inflation. Greece has not had that option. They've cut spending, they've implemented tax increases, and the result in Greece is a deflationary environment. So, what does that mean for you and your nest egg? Are we going to see inflation? Are we going to see deflation? And what asset classes perform best in each economic environment? That's what we're going to talk about in the last segment of today's program. You'll want to stay tuned for that. If you want to learn more, I would encourage you to check out our new retirement rules class. We just finished a new retirement rules class this week. The next new retirement rules class will be held in June. On Saturday, June the 13th, it'll be held at the downtown campus of Western Michigan University. If you'd like to get more information or to register while capacity remains, all you have to do is go to the website, newretirementrules.com. You can get more information there or you can register. I'll be back with Jeffrey Tucker after these words. Stay with me.
Give me your money. Just give me money.
Welcome back to Everything Financial Radio. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. I have the pleasure of chatting once again today with returning guest to the program, Mr. Jeffrey Tucker. Jeffrey is the author of Bit by Bit, How Peer-to-Peer is Freeing the World. He is also the editor at Laissez-Faire Books and the director of digital development at the Foundation for Economic Education. Jeffrey, we were talking in a prior segment about, just started to touch on some of these peer-to-peer networks and the challenge it really poses to regulators as to how do they get their arms around it, and they really can't. Let's talk about some specific peer-to-peer networks that maybe you mentioned in your book.
Well, yeah, I think probably everybody has used things like Craigslist and eBay. Those are probably the oldest two of the big peer-to-peer networks. And what those did was actually, in retrospect, kind of awesome. You know, they turned the whole world into an open bazaar put together by just individuals. So you list your stuff, you can sell your stuff to anybody, you can become an entrepreneur. You know, that kind of opportunity for selling goods and services around the world had never existed before. And it's an awesome thing to consider. It's dramatically changed the price structure, made the world much more competitive. Maybe you've experienced this from time to time. I've stumbled across something in my home that I thought was extremely valuable and thought, well, I could do with that and I'll sell it on eBay. And then you go to eBay and you'll need to discover that, you know, that there are thousands of other people who had the same idea. And instead of your toaster, your antique toaster being worth, you know, $500 like you thought, it's actually worth $5, you know. That happens to us all the time. And, it's put a lot of downward pressure on prices, which I think is a really good thing. That's what competition always does. But it's made the world sort of more efficient and more globally informed about existing scarcities and provided new opportunities for people to engage each other. So that's really exciting. But that was just the beginning. You know, we talked in the last segment about Airbnb, but it's true with things like job hunts now. I know so many people who have left their corporate jobs to become independent contractors by using, you know, the many services that are out there that provide opportunities for this sort of thing. So you just, you know, post your talents on a message board, and people have the opportunity to engage you for a temporary period of time, and people are able to basically turn themselves into their own CEOs of their own private companies, you know, through these kinds of services. This has been a godsend in a time where, because of government regulations, unemployment is very, very high. So we've been saved, essentially, by peer-to-peer technology in the job marketplace. I should also mention it's true for things like occupational licensure. You know, we used to think that you're not allowed to fix somebody's plumbing or repair their electricity or work on their things around the house or whatever, unless you had a license to do it. You know, most localities regulate all these kinds of things. It's perfectly silly. But with a service like TaskRabbit, all you have to do is post the fact that you're good at fixing toilets or good at fixing sinks or you can clean somebody's carpets. And next thing you know, you've got a job, you know, so it's very beautiful. And it's not just TaskRabbit. I mean, we're seeing these things emerge, you know, in every area of life. Like if you want to take tennis lessons, now there are applications that allow you to hook up with a local tennis teacher. Or if you teach piano or ballet, or you're good at German and somebody needs a German teacher, there are applications for every one of these services out there. And it's awesome when you consider that in the past, there wasn't really any means to kind of like link together service providers and people who wanted the services on a peer-to-peer basis. I mean, you could always take an ad in the local newspaper, something like that, but it's very inefficient and ineffective. But so these information asymmetries are starting to vanish in light of all the technology, and it's coming into headlong conflict with all the ways we've tried to manage the world in the past, through occupational licensure, very severe taxing, the IRS's, you know, tendency to want to codify and freeze everybody's jobs, you know, and tax it and name it and identify it. Things like, you know, you look back at some silly regulations that came out in the New Deal where you had things like maximum work hours during the day and during the week, and mandates concerning break times and vacation times and all this nonsense. I mean, these peer-to-peer services are just wiping all that out, you know? If you're an independent contractor, do you really care whether that the government tells you you can't work more than 40 hours a week? Of course not. I mean, it's ridiculous. You know, people are ready to work however much they can be valuable to others. So these old New Deal structures are just crumbling.
You know, as I'm listening to you talk, Jeffrey, and you mentioned something like occupational licensure. I don't know what the statistic is, but it seems to me that I read a statistic that, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, like 1 in 20 occupations required a license, and now it's down to like 1 in 3 or 1 in 4 or something silly like that. Do you see this reversing this whole trend of having to be licensed to be an interior decorator and, you know, pick out colors, I mean, to name one that's ridiculous?
It's got to. You know, it's just absurd. You know, Dennis, just to tell you a quick story, I remember a few years ago, my town was hit by a tornado. And there were trees down all over town, and people's plumbing wasn't working, and their electricity was down, and just a lot of fixes to do. And I remember the local government, absurdly, you know, went around and put into everybody's mailbox, all over town, so the whole town is a mess, right? And the government put into our mailboxes a sign that said, do not hire anybody but a licensed professional to do things like cut down your trees, or fix your plumbing, or deal with your appliances. It's extremely important. If you want to know who's licensed, then, you know, come to the city government, we'll tell you. Well, I mean, I had to laugh at a message like that. And in a case of emergency, like we face, nobody cares about that nonsense. You want the job done, you don't care if it's done by a licensed professional. You know, that's just perfectly silly. Well, that was just a foretaste of what was to come, because nowadays, with the kind of peer-to-peer technologies we face, we're ready to hire anybody to do anything, and we don't care where they live, what their credentials are. Everything these days, Dennis, is more and more coming down to reputation. And the digital world is very good about allowing you to accumulate a reputation and earn one and earn the trust of strangers just because of your profile. And that's very interesting to me, that reputation and trust between individuals is a much more important sort of tradable commodity than any piece of paper or credentials or anything like that. And you find this out very quickly if you're trying to sell something on Amazon and you have a low rating as a seller, like you were late sending out the product or something like that, that's going to hurt your business. Or if you try to be a customer of Airbnb, the person who's going to open up their home to you and let you stay in their house wants to know, you know, are you clean? Are you nice? Are you gracious? Do you have good manners? You know, do you pay your bills? These kinds of questions are extremely important. I faced this the other day because I newly registered at Airbnb and tried to get a space for a friend. Well, I was regarded as somewhat suspicious because I had just registered for the site. Well, so I had to go the extra length to explain myself and to convince the person who was opening up his home to me, to a friend of mine, that I was legitimate. You know, so these kind of trust-based systems that are working entirely on a market-based peer-to-peer basis are much, much more important these days than things like government certification and regulation. And I just think the implications for human liberty are extremely profound. And if we can make government systems of control and command obsolete through peer-to-peer technology, then liberty has a truly happy future.
So, Jeffrey, just in the time we have left, let's talk about some of these other peer-to-peer networks. You had mentioned in the first segment that we recorded that it's really affected transportation. Can you expand on that for the listeners?
Yeah. Well, it's been a beautiful thing. In my whole life, every major city has had a taxi cab monopoly, and nobody's been known what to do about it. You know, these are perfectly absurd and silly. We don't need a monopoly for taxis. Anybody can drive anybody everywhere, and people should be free to do that on a profitable basis. But, of course, most cities erected these taxi monopolies. Well, all these new services that have come along, like Uber, and there are many others like that, that have just blasted apart these monopolies so anybody can register to be an Uber driver. If you get approved, you get an application on your phone. You can get paid for picking up somebody and getting them to where they want to go. And anybody who's used one of these services knows exactly what I mean. They're so much better than official taxi monopolies. They're more efficient, they're cleaner, they're cheaper, you know? And that's just the beginning. There's a service that I'm considering using that just opened up the other day, and I'm sorry I don't remember the exact name of it, but it allows you to park for free at the airport, and while you're out of town, they rent your car out to somebody else. And so then when you get back in town, they deliver your car back to you with a all vacuumed and cleaned and newly detailed and washed, and you don't pay for the parking, and they even give you a kickback on the amount of on some of the money that they gain from renting out the car. So, you know, things like this are just making our lives much happier and revolutionizing the way we think of service provision. These are incredibly incredibly brilliant, creative solutions to human problems that only markets can come up with. Governments are not good at coming up with new innovative ideas on making the world a better place. Markets are. So if we want the world, if we want progress in our time, we want the world to become ever more prosperous and flourishing, the only way is to put greater faith in people and less faith in governments. And I think that's where we're headed.
Well, it is an exciting time. And Jeffrey, I've got about a minute and a half left. Give the listeners an update on your Liberty.me project.
Oh, listen, you know, Liberty.me is just going so well. Every single night we have live classes. I'm doing one tonight, a live session with Julie Borofsky in Washington, D.C. It's so much fun. It's a wonderful alternative to mainstream social media and provides the publishing platforms and learning opportunities for people who love liberty all over the world. It's not necessarily about politics. It really is about taking charge of your life as a free person. That's what Liberty.me offers. And, you know, I, as you know, Dennis, I work for the Foundation for Economic Education, and we're about the same thing. We try to give ways for people to empower themselves and to live freer lives regardless of the political trends. I really think this is the way forward. Politics hasn't worked out so well for those of us who want to see the world freed, but taking individual initiative in your own life has done very, very well for us, and I'd like to see that continue. And that's pretty much all the things I do now professionally revolve around that theme, whether it's Foundation for Economic Education or Laissez-Faire Books or Liberty.me.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Mr. Jeffrey Tucker. Always a pleasure to have him on the program. His book is Bit by Bit, How P2P is Freeing the World. I'd encourage you to check it out. It's available. There's a Kindle option as well at Amazon. I encourage you to check it out. Jeffrey, thank you for joining us today. Hope you'll come back.
Thank you so much, Dennis. Wonderful to talk to you.
Everything Financial Radio returns after these words. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. And thanks to our special guest, Mr. Jeffrey Tucker, for joining us today. On today's program, we are talking about inflation and deflation. And in the second segment of today's program, I asked the question, how can Greece be going through a deflationary depression and at the same time on the same planet have a country like Argentina that's experiencing 40% inflation in 2014? In fact, in the second segment of today's program, I talked about the fact that if you look at what a Volvo car cost in Argentina back in 2001, today a Samsung smartphone costs about the same amount. So just 14 years later, that's the effect that inflation has had on the economy in Argentina. The bottom line is that inflation occurs when the money supply expands, and deflation occurs when the money supply contracts. Now, when you look at what's happened in Argentina, Argentina has been adding money to the financial system because they have really been cut off from international credit markets. They can't go borrow money. So the only way they can finance their deficit spending is to print money. And when you print too much money and the money supply expands too quickly, the end result is inflation. And one of the symptoms of inflation is, of course, rising consumer prices. On the other side of the coin, Greece, which is part of the euro, can't print money. The politicians in Greece, in order to solve their deficit problem, have just two choices. They can raise taxes or they can cut spending. They have done both, but the process has been extremely painful. Youth unemployment in Greece is approaching 60%, as we talked about in the second segment of the program today. And when you take a look at economics, the GDP, or gross domestic product, of Greece has contracted significantly by about a third over the last 7 years. So basically, when you look at debt and the factor that debt has to be taken care of, governments have a couple choices. They can either print money or they can raise taxes and cut spending. And if the money supply contracts as a result of not printing money, we get deflation. If the money supply expands faster than money is removed from the system, or money is added to the system, I should say, faster than money is removed from the system, the outcome is inflation. Now, there was a report published by the McKinsey Global Institute, February of 2015, just a couple months old, and the title of the report is Debt and Deleveraging. Many of you probably think that because we had a financial crisis in 2007 that was largely related to and due to debt excesses, that the situation has improved. However, the situation has not improved. I'll give you just a bit from the report. And again, if you'd like to check out this report, it's published by McKinsey & Company, titled Debt and Deleveraging. Deleveraging is an economist term meaning that debt has been purged from the system. The report starts by saying, after the 2008 financial crisis and the longest and deepest global recession since World War II, it was widely expected that the world's economies would deleverage. They would start to get rid of debt. It has not happened. Instead, debt continues to grow in nearly all countries in both absolute terms and relative to GDP, or gross domestic product. When you hear the term GDP, you could loosely interpret that as income. Well, if your debt rises faster than your income rises, which is really what this report is saying, that is an unsustainable pattern. It's an unsustainable trajectory, to use the term you hear a lot today. And at a certain point, that trajectory has to reverse. So the report concludes this creates fresh risks in some countries and limits growth prospects in many others. Since 2007, listen to this, global debt has grown by $57 trillion. The ratio of debt to gross domestic product, or debt to income, loosely translated, is up 17 percentage points. That's significant. So while the financial crisis was caused by debt excesses, the debt excess problem has actually gotten worse. Government debt, when you look at government debt has grown by $25 trillion since 2007. So roughly speaking, about 40% of this debt increase is attributable to an increase in government debt, while the rest is attributable to private sector debt. Both are important, and I'll explain why they're important as this segment progresses. Households worldwide have continued to borrow more. Now, in the four core crisis countries that were hit hard back in 2008, that would be the United States, the United Kingdom, Spain, and Ireland, households have deleveraged or gotten rid of debt some. But in many other countries, household debt-to-income ratios have continued to grow, and in some cases far exceed the peak levels in the crisis countries. The report says to safely manage high levels of household debt, more flexible mortgage contracts, clearer personal bankruptcy rules, and stricter lending standards are needed. Well, clearer bankruptcy rules simply means there has to be an easier way for people to walk away from debt. China's debt is rising rapidly. China's total debt, rather, has quadrupled, rising from $7 trillion in 2007 to $28 trillion by mid-2014. China now has debt to GDP or debt to national income, on a percentage basis, it's higher than that of the United States. The United States has a 269% debt to GDP ratio. China's at 282%. Spain's at 401%. And Japan is at an eye-popping 517%, according to the report. Now, the report has an executive summary, and I want to give you just a paragraph from the executive summary. 7 years after the global financial crisis, global debt and leverage have continued to grow. From the second through the second quarter of 2014, global debt grew by $57 trillion, raising the global debt to GDP by 17 percentage points. So again, if your debt to income ratio rises, that can only continue for a period of time. And the bottom line is this: if there's too much debt to be paid, it simply won't all be paid. And all these countries, the United States included, have three choices to deal with the debt. They can raise taxes, cut spending, or print money. Now, depending on what choice they make, there are only two predictable outcomes. We will have deflation, maybe like we're seeing in Greece, or we'll have inflation, maybe like we're seeing in Argentina. Now, admittedly, those are extreme examples, but the debt still has to be paid. Japan has been printing for the last 20 years, and they've had a muddle-through economy, and their economy is continuing to lag. Their economy is continuing to get worse, and all they have done is added a whole bunch of debt to the country's balance sheet, the debt ratio of 517%. Now, in a deflationary environment, stocks decline, historically speaking. In an inflationary environment, stocks may rise, as they have nominally in the United States here over the last 14 years, but they don't rise in real terms. So when you take a look at where interest rates are today, if the next big move in interest rates will be up, in your opinion, that's going to be bad news for bond funds. If deflation kicks in, that could be bad news for stock funds. So the one bucket approach that many folks take, which is simply taking some of your assets and putting them in stock-based investments, some of your assets putting them in bond-based investments, may fail in the future. You may need to add some asset classes that are not normally considered. That's what we talk about in our new retirement rules class and give you a roadmap to help you navigate what we believe may be a very difficult environment moving ahead. If you'd like to get more information about our new retirement rules class, you can go to the website, newretirementrules.com, and there is a bunch of information posted there. You can also register there for our next class, which will be held on Saturday in June, on June the 13th. Again, the website is newretirementrules.com. I'd encourage you to check it out. That's our program for this week. Hope you got something you can use. Have a great week. Bye.